welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Welcome back to the Managing Violence Podcast. Thank you so much for your patience while we had a short little break to recalibrate, reload, and re-engage with our mission of creating the world's leading free resource on violence management. I've got a great guest today, but before we get to that, I've got a couple of announcements to make. Firstly, if you're in the UK, if you're in the United Kingdom, or anywhere close to the United Kingdom, I'm coming to you. I'm going to be in the United Kingdom from approximately March 24th until April 12th, give or take a few days, depending on requests, to teach some seminars. We've already got a confirmed booking in Oxford, but I'm open to bookings for anyone who wants to host me or have me pop in and teach a class at your dojo over that period. So for full information, I've created a page on the website, rather, with all the information for prospective hosts. And that can be accessed at www.violencepod.com/UK tour. violencepod.com/UK tour. Secondly, if you're new or you've just forgotten, consider this your reminder. We have a tremendous community on Facebook. If you search for Managing Violence Tribe, we will pop up as a number one suggestion. Make sure you head on to Managing Violence Tribe. We're closing in on 1,000 members. Really dignified, respectful conversation around this very important topic, so make sure you check that out. Also, be sure to check us out on Instagram at Managing Violence, on Facebook at Managing Violence, Twitter at Joe Saunders MVP, LinkedIn at Managing Violence Podcast, and YouTube at Managing Violence with Joe Saunders. And last but not least, if you get value out of this podcast and you'd like even more, please consider contributing at patreon.com/managing violence. Our Patreon protector community receive bonus content, special videos, members-only webinars, and more, really. There's a ton of other stuff for as little as $5 a month. There's absolutely zero pressure. You can cancel any time, but every contribution is hugely, hugely appreciated. That's it for the announcements. It's so good to be back. I'm joined on this very first episode back by Spencer Corson. Spencer is the founder of Corson Security Group and the author of The Safety Trap. It's a great conversation, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. So here we go with Spencer Corson. All right, I'm joined here at the Managing Violence Podcast by Spencer Corson. Spencer, thanks for joining us.
Joe, pleasure. How are you, my friend?
Doing very well, doing well. And a shout out to Jack Leskova. Jack is a listener of the show, recommended support. Yes. Spencer, thanks for connecting us. And Jack, thanks for recommending Spencer's book, which I bought that day, have devoured, and enjoyed it so much, I thought I needed to get Spencer on the show. So shout out to Jack.
That, Joe. Thank you. Yes, thank you, Jack.
So Spencer, look, I mean, your background is substantial. You're a combat veteran. You've worked in executive protection, celebrity protection fields, threat assessment, threat management. Do you want to give listeners just a bit of a snapshot of who you are and your journey so far?
Sure. My name is Spencer Corson. I am a threat management professional. I am the founder of Corson Security Group. We specialize in threat management, protective intelligence, and vulnerability reduction. Like you said, after Kai doubled it, I had a double major in psychology and sociology at university. Wanted to go work for the Secret Service or the FBI at that time, had an internship with the Justice Department, and they were like, well, you know, you need a couple of years post-collegiate experience before you can just roll into the government. Why don't you go into the military? It'll make for a nice lateral transition. You get your weapons and tactics, security clearances, what have you. It's 1999. There's absolutely nothing going on in the world. And I was like, yeah, great. Why not? So like 3 weeks later, I was at Fort Bragg. But because I had enlisted with a college degree, I got kind of fast tracked. So I got to go immediately to airborne school and Ranger selection. And then, you know, as soon as like all that fun training was done, we were on September 11th coming back from a morning workout, just as the, you know, second plane was hitting the towers. And that was, of course, a big game changer. Not sure when this comes out in October, but, you know, September 11th is just around the corner here. While I was serving in the military, got recruited to work for the government, was doing a lot of diplomatic security work. Did about 300 protective missions to 163 different countries in about a 10-year span. And then was recruited to work for Gavin De Becker and Associates, who, of course, we both know well, author of The Gift of Fear, where I was his deputy director of protective services. 2012 rolls around. I guess it was actually 2011. I was pulled over to go work on a movie called Zero Dark Thirty we were filming in Jordan and in Chandigarh, India. And of course, Chandigarh was right on the Syrian border, as you know, Syria was running out of coffins. So I was, you know, leveraging my embassy contacts to sort of keep the cast and crew safe. And it's funny, like if you Google me today, it still comes up as like Spencer Corson actor, because there was an actual canine named Cairo on the actual Navy SEAL raid. And so they had an actor and a German Shepherd dog that were going to portray that part of the movie, but the dog didn't have the right shot, so got turned around by Jordanian customs. So Catherine Bigelow one day in the chow hall was like, "Hey, Spencer, you were in the army, right?" I was like, "Yes, ma'am." She's like, "How are you with dogs?" I was like, "Great." She's like, "You're my canine SEAL." So if you happen to be watching Zero Dark Thirty and you don't blink for that 1/10 of a second that I'm actually on the screen, I'm the one that's on the other end of the leash of the dog as he's jumping on and off the helicopter.
I will say, when I first Googled you, I did see Spencer Corson actor, and I was like, interesting.
I have tried to get it changed so many times, but what are you going to do? Of course, then 2012 happened, which was here in America, the tragedy at Sandy Hook. And both of my parents were teachers. And when you have family and friends who are, you know, in fear and asking for help, you want to do everything you can. And I realized in that moment that while, you know, my particular skill set and the skill set of my peers were being ultimately employed by that top 1% of the world's elite, the other 99% of the world, you know, still wanted to be, you know, still deserve to be protected. Because, you know, like I say in the book, while not everyone will know the luxury of having their own protective detail, everyone deserves to be protected. And so Corson Security Group was born from there, because what I wanted to do was still provide services to the private families and the high net worth clients. But I also wanted to make sure that I also had time to work with domestic violence shelters and, you know, student athletic groups and, you know, the more local in need concerns. And the book, The Safety Trap, is really ultimately an extension of that, because, you know, most people won't ever need a Spencer Corson in their life to help them, you know, reduce risk and prevent violence. But every single one of us can, you know, every single one of us will at some point be targeted by harm or disruption or what have you. And I think one of the things that gets a lot of people into trouble is that they don't necessarily make the wrong decision, but they don't necessarily have all of the information to make the correct decision. And so this book is really a compilation of protective strategies to help you live your very best life the safest way possible.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's a great summary. But one thing that really grabbed my attention was just the title, The Safety Trap. And then and then like early on in the book, you explain what a safety trap is. So that's a phrase I hadn't heard before. And it's a concept that as soon as it was explained, it made all the sense in the world to me. So what is a safety trap?
Sure. The safety trap, in its essence, it was a term that I came up with a few years before writing the book to sort of explain to my clients how sometimes feeling safe is the most dangerous thing we do. Because as our fear goes down, our risk goes up. Because as our vigilance goes down, we're not paying attention to those pre-incident indicators. And it's very easy. You know, we are at our core emotional creatures. And so safety, like the biggest difference I would say between like safety and security is that safety is ultimately a feeling, whereas security is a state of being. So if you were to, you know, extrapolate this to something, you know, very simple, like an umbrella, the canopy above you, which is like keeping you warm and dry from the rain that's falling down, is the security. But knowing that that canopy is working as it's expected to is your safety, because you're warm and dry underneath. Now, while that umbrella may work very well in a light drizzle or a light rain, if you were to then take that umbrella out into a hurricane and expect it to work as effectively, you'd be like, hey, what's wrong? And now you're anxious and anxiety because you had this false expectation that something that performed in one context would, you know, not perform or would perform the same way in another. And then, of course, we get disheartened when it does not. But like, you know, that concept is something that parents know very well. Like a child, like embraced by a mother's hug, feels safe, but a mother's love alone is not enough to keep that child protected from the evils of the world. Conversely, if that child is secure tucked in their bed at night, that child may not feel safe if they believe that there is a monster hiding in the closet. So ultimately, for us to be protected, safety and security need to be in concert with one another.
Very well said. I see so many parallels to this. I mean, my profession is workplace violence consulting and working a lot with around violence prevention. And the number of clients that are well-meaning, but they think they've got their workplace violence sorted because they employed a security guard at minimum wage, or they put in cameras, or they put in panic buttons or duress buttons or something. And like, okay, no, we've sorted that problem now. It's like, really? Do you understand how these are actually going to work? Like, I
mean, right. Well, and you know, that's an interesting, you know, connotation, because, you know, sometimes when we're walking into like a grocery store, a department store, and we see the signs, hey, you know, this place is protected, you know, under 24-hour surveillance. And then you look up and you see all the cameras. And then as you're walking inside and you see the anti-theft devices, and then you see the guard, and then you look up and you see all the domes, and you're like, oh, wow, this place takes their security really seriously. It's very easy for you then in that moment to kind of lower your vigilance, but that means your risk is going up, because the reality is that all of those safety features that you're noticing, they're not there for you. They're there to protect the products. Much like how, like, if you put like a Ring camera on your front door, it's not there to protect the mailman. It's there to protect your house. And so, you know, sort of explaining and getting people to understand, oh yeah, that makes sense, that whoever is employing or deploying those security assets, it's there to protect the person who implemented them. You know, it's like, just because, like, if you saw, you know, Taylor Swift walking down the street with a bodyguard, just because there's security present doesn't mean that security is there for you.
Absolutely. That overlay of the different security priorities and the protocols, and yeah. And even then, we have to assume that there's human failings at all levels of those security controls, and they're not always going to work the way that even we expect them to, let alone
right, because there's all, I mean, and you know this when you do audits, but I do a lot of, you know, security audits for, you know, corporations and organizations and what have you, and there's always a very wide divide between policy and practice, between absolutely what it's supposed to be and what it actually is. Like when I'm, you know, we'll be doing audits at schools, for example. And, you know, as the students come in, it's very regimented. But let's say like Johnny forgets his lunch, right? It's supposed to be, well, the mom calls the school, says Johnny forgot his lunch. The mom's supposed to drive, then, you know, call, then check in, then press the buzzer. Then the person's supposed to like check them in at the front. Like there's like 10 steps. And what actually happens, it goes from buzzer pressed, access granted, right? Because the person who's responsible for doing all of that vetting, this is the 15th time Johnny's forgot his lunch, and they're inundated with a million other priority taskings. And then it just becomes buzzer pressed, access granted. And they don't even think to look up to notice that there's someone like some bad guy piggybacking in, you know, behind that mom, because in their research and planning, they knew that Johnny was eventually going to forget his lunch again. And that was the vulnerability that they were going to exploit to, you know, conduct that attack.
Absolutely. Like probably 90% of security breaches that we ever investigate are not a breach in the system. They're a breach in the human execution of the system.
Yes.
That's just the fact. We're always going to be the
worst. Yeah. And that's like across the board, like on the physical security space, on the cybersecurity space. Like it's not that, you know, I talk about alert fatigue in the book, because, you know, it's not that the alert didn't occur and it's not that they didn't hear it. It was just, you know, as commonplace as like hearing a car alarm. Like, when was the last time you actually took the time to investigate that sound?
Absolutely. One of the topics that you lead off with in the book is this topic of avoidance or just ignoring a problem and hoping it'll go away. Mm-hmm. And you have a great example of that from a TV actress that you were looking after. I find this is something that applies across the spectrum, whether we're talking about public life or we're talking about private life, we're talking about people in a relationship that has all the red flags, or they've got someone in their life that seems to be a bit unhinged. There's so many things that we can turn a blind eye to with this sort of this optimism bias that it's going to end up playing out okay because bad things don't happen to me and I'm probably just being paranoid.
Right.
Can you explain this concept maybe quick give a rundown of that story?
Sure. So I'll give you the rundown first, and then I'll explain what happened. So what basically happens is, and we see this all the time, where you'll have a public figure or a CEO or a teacher or whoever starts getting some kind of like inappropriate communication, whether it's a text message or an email or a phone call, and they just don't want to deal with it. So out of sight, out of mind, don't want to deal with it. But then, of course, what happens is if you don't resolve, you know, today's concerns are tomorrow's crisis. So like if you don't want to deal with today's problem, you know, it's like present pain or future torment. Which one do you want? Because the act of avoidance is a very natural, ingrained, learned, you know, self-defense mechanism, which is, you know, ultimately propped up by the "it won't happen to me" mantra, right? Because like you were saying, there's that optimism bias that I'm a good person and so good things are going to happen to me. If I was a bad person, I could understand why something bad would happen, but that's just not the reality of the world we live in.
And bad people don't usually recognize they're bad people, so it's be a bad person as well, just so you know.
100%. We call them sociopaths. But, you know, like I was saying, what happened was, is this particular TV star didn't, you know, was getting these communications from this fan who was being obsessive and explicit and what have you. And so she just didn't want to deal with it. But then, you know, a couple of days go by and she doesn't hear anything, but it's because she's got them blocked and going to this like, you know, junk folder. And then a week later, it's out of her, you know, everyday thoughts. And then a month later, it's out of her head completely. And then, of course, 6 weeks later, she's filming outside for a part of a TV production, and this guy shows up. Now, he had been communicating his intent to stage a confrontation with her all along. But because she had chose to avoid those warning signs, because she had chosen to ignore those pre-incident indicators, she was then forced to confront that crisis because she chose to not address that concern at the onset when it was at a distance and at its most easily manageable and resolvable. Because a lot of times when we just choose to ignore something, what we're really doing is just giving it the room to grow. And one of the things that avoidance kind of, you know, is this going to turn into something? Like, you don't know. It's probably a very low likelihood, but when it's happening, it's 100%. So wouldn't you rather know that going forward rather than being caught off guard? Like, no one fears that which they know well, but so many of us are looking to, and this I think really comes down to the underpinnings of avoidance, is that we are not comfortable being uncomfortable. And if we just take a few minutes to realize, oh, this is a very easy thing to learn and adapt and to improvise and to overcome, we can, you know, alleviate and eliminate so many potential problems. But when we simply, you know, hope that nothing will happen and then solely rely on the first responders to save us once something does, we kind of, you know, put ourselves into a safety trap.
That avoidance and denial, and you said quite perfectly there that people just don't like to be uncomfortable and thinking about bad things happening, mm-hmm. or thinking that this this annoying creep is not going to go away is an uncomfortable feeling. And when you don't have expert knowledge or you don't have an expertise in it, or you don't have any education in it, it's very easy for your mind to run away with very scary thoughts about how this might play out. And those thoughts are uncomfortable. So we tend to just block those out. And yeah. It's like you're either in complete denial or complete panic, and there's no real middle ground of these are the logical things I can do to control this, or I'm going to reach out to someone like Spencer Corson and get advice on how to handle this.
Right. And there's also a big difference between the types of stalkers that the everyday person would encounter and the kind of person that a public figure would encounter. The everyday citizen tends to know who that stalker was. There was some kind of, like, they worked together, they saw them at the gym, they were the you know, delivery guy. There was some kind of either an unrequited advance or an unrequited someone asked you out and you said no, or you went out and it didn't work out and there was a breakup. Whereas with public figures, there's a real factor of mental illness at play, because it's not that those people saw you and liked you and you went out one time and you had a great time and you wanted it to be the love of your life and they didn't. It's that they have no real relationship with you, and they believe mentally in their head that, like, when you're saying your lines, you're actually talking to them. And so the rationale, it's very easy if someone is in your interpersonal dynamic to avoid them and cut them off because they're not going to keep reinvesting an effort that's not going to have any return on that investment. It's completely different for the impersonal, mentally challenged individual who doesn't pick up on those nuances and on those indicators. And they actually may think, oh, you're ignoring me. That's because you want me to double down on my efforts to prove to you how much I love you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people may avoid something and then go on Google and be like, oh no, Cosmopolitan says I should just, like, not answer the phone. When actually you may not want to answer the phone, but you also don't want to block that call, because then we're not going to know how many, threat assessment is ultimately like a time and information driven, modality. And so the more information we have over time and space, the more likely we can, manage that unfavorable circumstance towards its most favorable resolution.
Moving on to a different topic, because I listened to your book as an audio book. I also bought the Kindle as well, because I find that if I really enjoy a book on audio, I have to get it in a form that I can reference again as well. So I end up double buying books that I like, which is probably an expensive problem to have. But
well, I will make sure you get a signed copy of the physical book too.
Oh, there we go. So I have three copies. That's brilliant. You joined an elite club. I think Never Split the Difference might be one of the few books I have three copies of.
Great book. I have it. That's actually right there. Yeah.
Right there in your background.
Don Voss. Great book.
But I remember distinctly, I was listening to this section of your book while I was walking, and I found myself, like, physically nodding, and I thought I look like a crazy person because I'm nodding while I'm walking. You were talking about run, hide, fight. Okay, so we're talking about the active armed defender, active shooter situation, and I have massive issues with run, hide, fight as a concept. And I like run, hide, fight significantly better than the Australian model, which is escape, hide, tell. Right. I think run, hide, fight is superior to escape, hide, tell. I really dislike escape, hide, tell, but I also don't like run, hide, fight. So let's explore what is wrong with run, hide, fight in your view.
That it has basically been dumbed down to run to your hiding spot.
Yes.
Which is not at all what it was. So for people who may not know the origin of run, hide, fight, here in America, it stems from military application, SEER school, search, evade, resist, escape, where pilots and special operators are taught how to, if they're taken prisoner of war, to resist interrogation and then ultimately escape, evade, and if necessary, retaliate. So if you are a pilot or a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL or a Ranger or whatever, and you're taken prisoner and you get the opportunity to escape, great. Then you are going to run as far and as fast as you can, putting as much time and distance between you and the enemy, getting with each step you take closer to friendly forces. Now, if you get to the point where you are too tired and you can't possibly take another step forward, you will hide, you will camouflage yourself, you will regain your strength. And then as soon as you are able to, you will get up and continue on with your mission. Now, in the process of escaping, if you are then confronted by the enemy, you will fight like your life depends on it, because it absolutely does. So that is the framework from which, so escape, evade, retaliate was then turned into this cottage industry for schools to employ for their students. The problem is that run, hide, fight is a great practicum for an individual, but it is a horrible construct for a collective, especially a collective like a school or a business, which cares more about accountability than they do about survivability. Because what you see a lot of times in schools is that these police-aligned authors come in and they want to keep the threat contained, because the police are not responsible for your personal safety. They are responsible for the public's safety. And so if there's a bad guy in the mall, or if there's a bad guy in a school, or if there's a bad guy in the shopping mart, they don't want everyone fleeing so that that potential violent offender can then go off and spread that mayhem elsewhere. They want that to be contained in an easily identifiable and cordoned off area of operation, so that they can effective an arrest and also keep the rest of the area safe. But that does no good for you as an individual, because what that basically has become is run to your hiding spot, where you're going to go cower in a corner. And the thing is like so many of these like schools and businesses, it's not like they're hard structures. Right. So like watch a John Wick movie, like bullets travel through doors and walls very easily. And, you know, not only that, but it's like one of the reasons that so many schools and so many workplaces are attacked by insiders is because on the pathway to violence, there's a grievance, which typically is manifest at the school, where the ideation that they can do something about it is first realized, where research and planning is disguised as their everyday activity, where they don't really need to breach any kind of a perimeter because they're supposed to be there. And so the last were, you know, those gunshots are ultimately like, can you hear me now? Because so many of these students and so many of these, disenfranchised workplace people, they just don't have the emotional intelligence to ask for help. And so they act out in such a way that would indicate to a threat management or a threat assessment person, oh, these are behavioral anomalies that are outside the baseline, that are indicative of a pre-incident indicator of harmful ideation or violence. And so once you can pick up on them, but what we really have is these students act out in school and then they're sent to detention, right? It's punitive. And what are they told? Hey, just sit here, be quiet, don't talk, because no one here wants to deal with you either. And then this rage and this frustration and this grievance and this ideation continues to build and build and build. And then the next thing you know, it's, can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. But the thing with the run, hide, fight is that they've now participated in these, you know, safety lockdown procedures. So you've basically just like made their attack plan that much more effective, because now they know exactly where everyone's going to go. They know exactly what everyone's going to do. And all they have to do is now just take that insider information and apply it to their attack plan, ultimately making it that much more effective.
Yeah, I remember distinctly having this conversation, like, you know, if you're concerned about insider threats, they're going to know your procedures. And I had a client say to me, like, do you think they put that much thought into it? It's like, this is the only thing they've been thinking about for the last however long, right?
Right. And not only that, but they're studying from the success of people who have done it before. Absolutely. Oh, look at the notoriety that they came. Look, their name lives on forever. Okay, so they did this, I'm going to do this. You know, whether it's another active shooter incident, or if it's like a stunt on a football field or on a pitch or whatever, like successful stunts are the teaching tools of terror. because they're like, oh, I just have to do this. Oh, okay. And then they just keep building up, you know, upon that. Now, I'm not, which is not to say that sheltering in place does not have its appropriate purpose. There was a school not too long ago where there was like a liquor store was being robbed and the bad guy was engaged in a firefight with the police. The school initiated its lockdown, which they should do. And then as the bad guy was running from the police, tried to get into the school, but couldn't because the school was locked down because the threat was external to the school, which made locking down the school the right thing to do because the threat was outside. You're safe inside. If the threat is inside, get outside. Because here's a perfect example of where this went wrong. Washington Nationals baseball team playing a game in Washington, D.C. This is probably about a month ago now. There is a shooting outside the stadium, but the third base manager of the Padres thinks that the shooting is inside the stadium. So he has his team run into the dugout, which of course incites the panic of the fans. So all the fans think, oh, there's something bad in the stadium. We need to get outside. And now they're just running into harm's way. So what I always tell people is like, if you see a threat, act. But if you think you hear something or if someone's telling you something, like think about it, because like you don't want to just like follow the lambs to the slaughter just because, like we were talking about before, it'll make you feel safe, because feeling safe is ultimately what's going to get you into trouble if that decision is going to have an adverse effect on your security.
After reading this section where you're talking about the perils of hiding as a way, when you had the opportunity to escape, I mean the ideal is to be as far away from the bad thing as possible, right. However you do
put that, time and distance between you and the threat as possible, because first off, it's very easy to get away from someone who's not chasing you, but also it's very difficult to hit a moving target. Which would you rather be, like, which is harder to hit? Like the ball on top of the tee or the ball that's coming across the plate at like 95 miles an hour. Like, so do you want to be the child who's running away to an established safe haven, putting time and distance with each step you take? Or do you want to be the child who's like crying and cowering in the corner? I know which one I would want to be. And I know which one I would want my child to be.
Absolutely. Just after I read that section, I was watching a documentary on the Pulse nightclub shootings in Orlando. Hearing victim reports about how so many, I mean, like, I think a third of the casualties hid in the bathroom as opposed to exiting. They hid because they felt safe and secure in a bathroom. Whereas anyone who's ever fired a firearm will know that a cubicle wall is not going to help you. Let alone one that has a gap at the top and the bottom. Right. So, I mean,
And that's the thing, hiding is something we've been socialized to do. Like hiding is not innate. Like fight or flight, freeze or fawn, like those are innate, you know, trauma responses. But hiding, like we're not, you know, we don't have like cloaking, like we're not chameleons. We don't blend in with our environment. We're like big, obvious, clumbersome, you know, meat bags that are just like waiting to get punctured in a high stress environment. So like do everything you can to, you know, really put yourself in a position. And here's the thing. It's like, it's not that like people like need to live in fear that, oh, every time I go somewhere, like, but like, you know, when you get in your car, like you put your seatbelt on because it's a proactive way to keep yourself safe in the event you should get into an accident. If you walk into a bar or if you walk into a restaurant or a movie theater, like you should know where the exits are and you should know which way, like the more you can mentally like project what you will do and it should something happen, the better you're going to be, because now your mind is already like, you know, like with sports psychologists, they're always like, you know, visualize the, you know, the bat hitting the ball. Like when we're on protective details all the time, we're like, hey, sir, you know, just in case if anything bad breaks out, we're going this way. All right, cool. Thanks. Now I know. Because once you like have a plan, know where to go, know how to get there. And if you can just do that, like everywhere you go, it no longer becomes that burden of fear. It literally grows into a strength of empowerment, because mm-hmm. now you are actively participating in your own protection. And the more, like, all most people really need to stay safe is a healthy sense of skepticism and a moderate dose of vigilance. But what we cannot do is live on this fringe of the pendulum, swinging between complacency, where nothing's going to happen, to hypervigilance, where now we're, you know, patting down grandma at the ballpark. Like, a move to the middle is you know, everyday safety requires the participation of everyone. And that's a very simple price to pay for the liberties and the freedoms which flow so freely from peace.
Mm. Beautifully said. I think one of the things that I talk about a lot is this idea of mental blueprinting and giving yourself options. Yes. and a memory of something to do, because my experience is, under critical stress, people can't think of new things. Like, they can't create new plans when mm-hmm. they're under stress. So you have to create those plans when in times of peace or calm. And the analogy I use often is like a filing cabinet. Like, under stress, your brain is going to dig into that filing cabinet to find the appropriate response. If you've done this thing, like if you've done a full realistic emergency drill with lights and sounds and ambience and all that kind of stuff that we like to do, like when we have high budget training, then it's almost like the file with the answers is this bright pink fluorescent neon. Yes. Like, you can pull that file very quickly. If you've done sort of like a classroom training, then like the document is still there. It's just a little bit harder to find. And if you've mentally blueprinted it, you've even just thought about where the exits are, like the document's in there. It might be a little bit harder to access, but it's still in there somewhere. Whereas right. if you've never even thought about it, your brain is eventually just going to get to the back of the filing cabinet and go, I don't know, make shit up. Like, it's, you're going to do yeah. something similar.
No, I could not agree with you more. There's a phrase in Ranger School. I'm probably going to mess this up, but it's along the lines of, in combat, a man's brains turns to water and runs out his ears, and he relies on pure instinct alone. Mm. And it's not like, we're not talking about innate instinct. We're talking about like muscle memory. Like, I know how to do this. Okay. It's tools in your toolkit. Mm. Like, everyone knows how to use a hammer. Everyone knows how to use a saw. Everyone knows how to use a screwdriver, but not everyone knows how to use a tourniquet. Right. So if you're not familiar with using a tourniquet, like, you're not going to go to the tourniquet as it being your, you know, if you know how to use a Band-Aid, but you don't know how to use a tourniquet, and you see someone bleeding, you're going to go with what you know. And that's going to be the Band-Aid, but the Band-Aid's not going to get the job done. But if you had just like watched a YouTube video and like did it on yourself and kind of like went through, you're like, oh yeah, like a tourniquet, I know how to use that, because no one fears that which they know well. But you're completely right. You will only ever go for the tools that you already are comfortable using and have used before. And then you can maybe use those tools in new and improvised and, you know, unique and special ways. But what you're not going to do is go for the tool you've never used before. Like, I can't tell you how many times I'll do like a family residence plan. I'll go into the kitchen or the, you know, the pantry or whatever, and I'll see a fire extinguisher and be like, hey, when was the last time you guys practiced with this? And they're like, never. I'm like, okay, so you want the first time there's a fire for this to be a literal trial by fire. Like, why not buy two? You know, they're literally like $12. Buy two, practice with one, and then have the other one like ready to go and ready to, you know, to use. Like, do you understand like how to, you know, pull, point, you know, sweep and spray? Like there's, it's a, like, was it pass? Like, pull, aim, sweep, spray, right? But like, how many people have actually done that? And then, you know, they're like John Travolta in, you know, Look Who's Talking, where they're like, you know, literally trying to like read the instruction label while the kitchen's ablaze, trying to figure out how to get it done.
I remember one of the most stressful job interviews I had in the early part of my career. I was, I'd been involved in security for a little while. I think I was maybe like 23, 24. So I'd been working for about 3 or 4 years. And I was applying for this job as a security and fire protection officer at a hospital, because I wanted to get into their training team. I wanted to get into the healthcare training side.
Yeah.
And then the way in was from the inside. So I had to take this gig. And you know, did the interview. I was completely comfortable with my ability to interview for this job. And then they said, all right, we're going to do a practical assessment. And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. They took me outside and they set fire to a computer monitor that was full of I don't know, some, I guess, fire starters or something. And they gave me a fire extinguisher and said, put it out. And I was like, I've never used a fire extinguisher before. How the hell do I do this? And it made me realize how much we take for granted. Like the fact that I've every workplace I've ever worked in has had a fire extinguisher, and yet I've never used one up until that point in my life. I was like, how many people are walking past fire extinguishers every single day as a basic control, and yet have no idea how to use it?
Or Joe, here's something even like much more practical. Like, when was the last time you checked the status of the spare tire in your car?
Yeah.
Right. Like, you just expect it. Like, no, it's there. Right. Like, every time I open my trunk, I see the indent of like where it's stored. But like, when was the last time you checked the air pressure of that? Like, is it actually there? Or is that just like the cutout of where it should be? Because, you know, like, inspect what you expect. You know, it's sometimes just like really just a matter of like auditing yourself with honesty. You know, inspect what you expect, like measure what you measure they will meet. And, you know, the more that you can one of the things, I didn't want this book to be like a fear mongering book where it's like, there's dangers and darkness, like lurking around every corner. And as soon as you step outside, a bad guy's going to get you. No, it's not. This is protective strategies for living your very best life the safest way possible. But what that means is, what is the most realistic thing that's going to happen? What is the most likely bad thing that will occur? And then what are the most practical safeguards I can put into place to keep that bad thing from happening to me? Or if it does happen, to at least minimize and mitigate, you know, the impact. And that's it. That's it. Like, we don't stub our toes on the things we notice. We stub our toes on the things we don't. But it's not like that kid's toy in the kitchen was like hiding in the shadows and then like jumped out, you know, right before like you put your foot down. It was always there. You weren't looking for it. So you didn't expect to see it. Because you didn't expect to see it, you didn't see it. And you have that unintentional blindness. And then next thing you know, you're limping around the kitchen while you're trying to sip your coffee.
I'm reminded of a story from Richard Dimitri, who's one of my early instructors. And Rich will say, it's the things you don't expect that hurt you the most. And he used the analogy of like, you can go to the gym and you can do your Thai boxing, you can bang shin on shin. And it's like, yeah, it stings. But like, I mean, you're used to it. You're in the mode for it and you don't even notice it. And then you're walking through your house at 2 o'clock in the morning and half asleep, and you bang your shin on a coffee table. And it's like, you've been shot, right?
Because I completely agree. Yeah. One of the things my global experience has proven time and time and time again is that when we don't expect to see danger, we simply fail to see the warning signs that something bad is about to happen. But the warning signs are always there, and staying safe is ultimately about not just training ourselves to see them, but allowing ourselves to see them. Just like not having those blinders on, just allowing the information to come in, to be present, to be mindful. You know, so many people are like, when I talk about like situational awareness, they're like, listen, I'm not a soldier. I'm not James Bond. I'm not Ethan Hunt or, you know, Jason Bourne. I'm like, no, you don't need to be. But you like, situational awareness is really just mindfulness. It's about being present. It's about participating. It's about being aware of your surroundings. It's about, you know, knowing that if you're walking from a supermarket to your car, that is a natural transition zone where psychologically you're more likely to project forward to what you're about to go do or reflect back to what you just did because you want to make sure you're not forgetting or missing anything. But just having that presence of mind, oh, I'm entering a transitional zone. I want to just start looking around. Okay, blue car, guy in a black shirt. And if this guy in the green hat's acting a little creepy, I'm just going to look at him and go, green hat. Because if that was someone who had some kind of like nefarious intent to harm us, now you have just eliminated their anonymity and they're going to go after someone who's going to give them a better target. And if that person is not a threat, they're probably going to play along with your game and go, well, hey, blue shoes. And, you know, and now there's strength in numbers because now, you know, there's everyone is looking out for one another. But, you know, it's not like, this isn't The Farm. This isn't Spy Game. This isn't The Secret Squirrel, like, you know, brotherhood of, you know, like using your spoon to see who's behind you. It's just participating in your own protection. It's about being present. It's about being aware. It's about trusting your instincts. It's about trust, you know, it's trusting your instincts. It's being aware. It's having boundaries and it's being willing to participate, not be too polite, and perhaps be a bit disagreeable when that time should arise.
It's a really great segue to the last thing I wanted to talk about, which was the individual responsibility to take control of your own safety. And the reason I want to bring that up is because you make it's a tragic story. And obviously at time of recording, we're a couple of days shy of the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. And the story of workers that tried to evacuate that were turned around by a security guard operating under, I guess, their authority.
False authority is huge.
Yeah. So false authority or this assumption that authority figures are going to save us when, this authority figure, this guy, literally had no authority whatsoever, but people died because they listened to the word of a supposed authority. Right?
Yeah. And I don't know how it is in Australia. It's been a while since I've been back on that side of the world, but like here in America, like if you go to like a football game or a soccer game or a sports match, there's a bunch of people like in these like yellow or blue or black, and it's got like security on the back, right? I wish they would stop calling them security and either call them like an ambassador or protocol or logistics or whatever, because just because that person who's like tearing your ticket in half and can be like, oh, sweet, 100, it's that way, doesn't mean that they can like give you effective instructions in a crisis situation that you will literally have an impact on whether or not you survive. But in the absence of leadership, people will gravitate towards strength. And when you are, you're someone who isn't that well-trained, isn't that well-educated, is making like $10 an hour, like you want to like prop yourself up and be like, oh no, I'm going to take charge. And then you ultimately like probably wind up doing more harm than good. And so I think it's important for the everyday citizen or the everyday participant to be like, listen, but anytime someone is giving you instruction, whether that be for like your child's school or if you're at a stadium or whatever, like, why are they telling you what they're telling you? What is like, and then if it doesn't feel right, like feel free to make your own decision and go against the grain. Like never go to the evacuation point. If everyone is like running out one set of doors and you see another set of doors on the other side, I'd probably take that other set of doors because, it's very easy for people who aren't inoculated or conditioned in those high stress, real world combative environments to, like when you're walking down the street and you hear an airplane and then you look up and you think it's over there, but it's really over there. And it's because the acoustics of the sound bouncing off the building, like gunshots are the exact same way. They like bounce off. So it's, trust your eyes, but question your ears and just think, like, if you are not in a situation where you are immediately being targeted, you have time to assess and address the reality of the situation and participate in your own protection and to make smart decisions that will ultimately help to ensure the certainty of your own safety.
Absolutely. You can't outsource that responsibility. And at the end of the day, your intuition, your gut feeling, you're the one that's going to be responsible for the safety of you and your family. And if you're going to trust a guy who's on minimum wage and having been that guy on minimum wage, like this is not an indictment of security guards, but
yeah,
it's the reality is like you still have the responsibility to look after yourself and to do what you feel is right. And while it'd be nice if we could trust everybody that they're all going to be highly trained, we know the reality is they're not. It's one of those things. It's just another thing that we have to kind of, as human beings, I think, take responsibility for, like everything from start to finish, right? Do you have current first aid training? Do you know how to apply a tourniquet? Are your CPR skills up to date? Does your family know how to evacuate your house if it was on fire? Like these kinds of things that are pretty basic 101 stuff, people sort of negate it because, especially if you live in a first world country, we talk about this a lot in the Australian context because like we know that if we call 000, which is our 911, if we call 000, the police will come, right? And they're not likely to kill our whole family because we believe in the wrong religion, right? We know that if we call an ambulance, the ambulance will come and it will be relatively, it'll either be free or very cheap, right? So we're not going to be paying this off for generations. We know that if something's on fire, very highly trained people with very expensive equipment will be here very quickly to put that fire out. So because we have those safeguards in place, people just tend to be naive to any risk because they feel like people come to save them.
Well, and I, you know, and I talk about this in the book, like the safety trap of effective response, where, and this is really like here in America, like one of the problems that is confronting like schools and businesses is that they've gotten so good at responding to the threat once it has revealed itself that they're putting zero effort into preventing that threat from arising in the first place. Mm. You know, giving a fire truck faster engines is not going to prevent the fire from starting. It's just going to make it more effective at putting the fire out. Not building the building in kinder wood and uncovered wiring is what's going to, you know, like using steel and, you know, insulated wiring. And there's a reason for, you know, these things to take place. But just because you're really good at solving a problem, great, but let's prevent that problem first. Like that's really where the investment of time, effort, and energy should be spent.
Mm, absolutely. There's so much we could talk about. I highly recommend you pick up the book, The Safety Trap, Spencer Corson. Spencer, if people want to know more about Corson Security Group, or they want to book you to speak, or any of your other services, where do they go to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So the business, Corson Security Group, is corsonsecuritygroup.com. It's corsonsecuritygroup.com. And on there are links to, I am represented by Macmillan Speakers Bureau, who Macmillan is the parent company of St. Martin's Press, who is the publisher of the book. So I'm on their Speakers Bureau. So I'm available for corporate and public speaking events. And of course, The Safety Trap has its own website, thesafetytrap.com, which is also where I have my own podcast called Corson's Corner, Protective Strategies to Help You Succeed in Staying Safe. And what I do with that podcast is pretty much like how the book is framed. Here's what happened. Here's how it was allowed to happen. Here's how you can keep it from happening to you. I'm on Instagram at s.corson. I'm on Twitter at Spencer Corson. And if you Google me, I'm Spencer Corson, the actor. So we're going to get that changed. But Joe, thank you so much for having me. This was a true pleasure.
My absolute pleasure. And I hope we can do it again in the future. Spencer, you're going to stick around and do some bonus content for our Patreon contributors. But for those that are leaving us here, thank you very much. Thank you once again to Spencer Corson for a tremendous interview. Make sure you check out his book, The Safety Trap. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with the return of the one and only Dr. Jim Caywood. Dr. Jim Caywood will be back on talking about threat assessment and management. Until then, check out all things violencepod.com. And I'll talk to you next time.